President Donald Trump's decision to launch 59 Tomahawk missiles at a Syrian airfield last week has surprised and confused many national leaders in Europe and the Middle East. And Amos Giura, a professor of law at the University of Utah, says there remains no clear understanding of what happens next.
I mean, you can do various scenarios and simulations. Ask yourself, how will the Trump administration respond if this happens? How will the Trump administration respond if that happens? I think that, frankly, that the Trump administration has no idea how it will respond because it has failed to define two critical terms. And with this, I stop. One, what is America's national security? How do they define it? And two, how does America define its geopolitical interests presently?
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, a campus community dialogue, understanding our differences, shaping our future, terrorism, foreign policy, and American democracy. That discussion is coming up, but first, here's this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we are bringing you the latest in a series of conversations organized by the College of Social and Behavioral Science, the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and the Department of Political Science, and the Undergraduate and Graduate Student Advisory Councils at the University of Utah. The Campus Community Dialogue series, Understanding Our Differences, Shaping Our Future, has examined a number of pressing social and political issues so far this year and brought together many leading experts to help us all make sense of the challenges our community and our nation now faces. Today, the topic is terrorism, foreign policy, and American democracy. This conversation was recorded on Monday this week. To introduce this forum more broadly and to introduce the panelists, I'm handing it off to Mark Button, the chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Utah.
The subject of our dialogue today, as you all know, is terrorism, foreign policy, and American democracy. And from Syria to Iraq, to events in Egypt recently, to events in Paris, London, Stockholm, Orlando, people around the world are living with the bloody realities of terrorism, both foreign and domestic. And in this country, as we all know, President Donald Trump's executive order barring about 220 million people from seven majority Muslim nations from setting foot on U.S. soil was defended by underscoring how the measure aims to protect U.S. citizens from foreign-born terrorism. The fear of terrorism is real, and it is, of course, antithetical to a life of freedom, even if it's also the case that real-world data shows that Americans are six times more likely to die from a shark attack and 6.9 million times more likely to die from cancer or heart disease than by terrorists. The recent U.S. military strike ordered by President Trump against an airfield in Syria, without deliberation or approval from Congress, was defended as vital to the national security interests of the United States in preventing and deterring the spread and use of deadly chemical weapons. Now, all of these recent events pose a host of questions for us, constitutional questions, moral questions, as well as strategic and political ones. And so the two essential questions that we want to explore today are the following. How should we think about the relationship between national security and moral principles within the struggle against domestic and international terrorism? And secondly, what are the best ways to try to balance national security with constitutional and moral principles in practice? And to help us with these questions, we've invited, I think, a really stellar group of scholars and leaders to help us. I'm going to introduce you to them very briefly, and then each of them will take about 6 to 8 minutes to address those essential questions, and then we want to feature conversation with all of you and discussion with everyone here. So starting to my immediate left, Dr. Amos Giura is professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law. With expertise in international law, counterterrorism, and religion, he is the author of several books, including Complicity, The Bystander in the Holocaust, Global Perspectives on Cybersecurity, Tolerating Intolerance, The Price of Protecting Extremism, and Targeted Killing and the Law. His forthcoming book is entitled Justice, Earl Warren, Miranda, Individual Rights, and Terrorism. We're very pleased to have your expertise here today. Next to Professor Giura is a Supervisory Special Agent Daniel Brady of the FBI. Special Agent Brady has worked on issues related to terrorism and striving to counter violent extremism in North Africa, in Europe, in the Middle East, for going on 18 years. He's been recently promoted to be deputy of the FBI for the entire region for Utah, Idaho, and Montana. Despite being a BYU grad in international relations, we welcome him here today and thank him for his expertise. To his left is our very own Dr. Brent Steele, who is the Francis Warmoth Presidential Chair in the Department of Political Science. He will be recognized this week as a finalist for the Superior Research Award in the College of Social Science. And he has scholarly expertise in international relations, security, and ethics. Professor Steele is the author of three single-authored books, including the highly influential Ontological Security in International Relations, and over 30 different journal articles and numerous book chapters. He's also the co-editor of a forthcoming three-volume work on the Handbook on Ethics in International Relations. And finally, I'm very pleased to introduce you to Dr. Ivy Esterbrook, who is the executive director of USTAR, the Utah Science, Technology, and Research Initiative. Prior to joining USTAR, Dr. Esterbrook received, she was the program officer for basic research in the Expeditionary Maneuver Warfare and Combating Terrorism Department at the Office of Naval Research. Dr. Esterbrook is a cognitive neuroscientist by training with technical expertise in psycholinguistics, pharmacological interventions, and statistical modeling. She earned her doctorate in neuroscience from Georgetown University and a Master of Science in National Security Strategy and Resource Management from the Eisenhower School of the National Defense University. So with that introduction, please welcome our panelists. All right, so let's get into it. Our essential questions, each 6 to 8 minutes, and we'll start with Dr. Giora.
Not with you? No, okay. So good afternoon. Good afternoon. Enthusiasm. So the two questions that Professor Button has asked us to address go, I think, to the heart of the question facing the American electorate 2016, but perhaps more importantly, moving forward 2018 and then 2020. It strikes me that the critical question, if you think about terrorism and America in the world or America and the world, one of the fundamental questions is how do you define American national security, and how do you define American national security interests? So your politics are obviously of no interest to me and none of my business, but if you think about the events of the past 72 to 96 hours, you couldn't have teed this up better. There have been three critical events that really, in many ways, can shape our discussion today. One is America in Syria, slash there's this other small country called Russia, which I'll talk about. The attack, the horrible attack in Egypt, and the small attack in Sweden, where only by chance, only 4 people were killed, and only, right? So let's begin with Syria. President Trump, as candidate Trump, was very critical of President Obama, obviously, on two different things with respect to Syria. One, for drawing that famous red line and then not acting on it. And two, for drawing that red line because he felt that Obama made Syria part of American dialogue. Candidate Trump said as president he would never do this, 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 and this. And now President Trump is obviously acting 180 degrees different from candidate Trump. These things happen to these people. But it's important to note that. The Americans attacked this air base in Syria because of the chemical attack on, we've all seen the pictures. But I just find it, time after time after time again, a state of disbelief to believe that that awful attack, it was an awful attack, that in and of itself propels a president to put together his team and decide to, you know, shoot off the 49 or 59 Tomahawk missiles. And if that's what captivates a president, and if that's what leads a president to act, then woe be us. Because as awful as that attack was, I mean, the killing 100 people, how many other people were killed there, is awful. But it can't be, from my way of thinking, that that act in any way imperils American national security, however you define American national security. I would like to think that all of you know, yes, that the Assad regime is as barbaric as barbaric can be barbaric as barbaric can be barbaric. He's awful. He makes Saddam Hussein look like child's play. Okay. But, I mean, everybody knows that.
And to use that act, the attack on when it was Wednesday or Thursday, as the basis for an American attack makes no sense to me. Complicating it is whether or not the Russians knew about it in advance. Did they know? Did they not know? Because when you think about terrorism in American national security, you have to be able to think geopolitically. It's not enough to think about this attack. The question is, how does it impact American national security, geopolitical interests? And by the way, national security and geopolitics are not necessarily one and the same. So just if you think about, if you look at the map of the Middle East, you'll think about the following small countries, right, which are part of this discussion. There's a thing called Iran. There's a country called Turkey. There happens to be a country called Israel, where I come from. And then you have to ask yourself, was the intended recipient of those 59, right, it's 59 tomahawks, right? 59. Mm-hmm. Was the intended target really Syria, or was the intended target Russia, sending a clear message to the Russians, which I'll come back to in a second? Was the message to Iran? Was the message to Turkey? Or is the message to Hezbollah, the Iranian-sponsored terrorist organization in southern Lebanon? The answer is, I don't know. And what really concerns me in terms of national security, I'm not convinced if the administration had to articulate here, I mean, not, pardon my English, not a BS articulation, but a real articulation, I'm not convinced that they would be able to articulate. What's the difficulty with all that? If you look at the world today, particularly this complicated and complex region called the Middle East, the Russian re-influence in the Middle East has totally turned this thing on its head upside down. The Russians are clearly engaged in Syria, but I don't know how many of you have ever been to Syria. There's nothing interesting in Syria. Syria has zero natural resources. There's nothing in Syria. The question is, why are the Russians coming to Syria? Why are all these terrorist organizations here? What are they trying to influence? That's always the question. I think the answer is, it's unclear. But this attack on Thursday, I think, only adds to the disclarity, or the lack of clarity. That's point one. Point two, the attack in Egypt. So ISIS, or ISIL, or ICE, however you wish to describe it, is, again, if you want to talk about barbaric, they're barbaric. And this killing of the 45 cops as they were pre-Easter prayer is awful. But I haven't really seen, you know, a Trump administration response that he's in a bind here, because he had Sisi in Washington last week, and Sisi's got everything under control, but no, he doesn't. So again, in the terms of the lack of clarity and the lack of under controlness, the attack in Egypt and the Egyptian response, traditional Egyptian response, 3 months of emergency, state of emergency. By the way, that doesn't mean anything, but that's okay. And the third thing, Sweden. So you had a conversation here about immigration, I understand, recently. So I don't know how many of you traveled to Europe, but the issue in Europe, facing Europe today, being frank here, is immigration. And the critical issue with respect to European immigration is Muslim immigration to Europe. That's the issue. I spent a lot of my time in Europe, but that's the issue. And the Swedes are really struggling. What do you do with Muslims? Do you let them in, or do you kick them out? So the guy who did the attack on Friday, had been denied asylum, but somehow stays. Okay, so I'm not exactly sure how that happens. If you combine all this together, here's where we are. Before I turn it over to the three of you, from my perspective. The Trump administration's act on Thursday has served to utterly confuse national leaders in Europe and the Middle East. This is not what they expected of the Trump administration. And I need to add that the fact that you fired 59 Tomahawk missiles, in no way is that a doctrine. There's now not a Trump doctrine. There's not a Trump policy. There was an act in response to, with absolutely no clarity of what happens next. So you can do various scenarios and simulations, asking yourself, how will the Trump administration respond if this happens? How will the Trump administration respond if that happens? And I think that, frankly, that the Trump administration has no idea how it will respond, because it has failed to define two critical terms, and with this I stop. One, what is America's national security? How do they define it? And two, how does America define its geopolitical interests presently? Next.
That was Amos Giora, professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW and a forum recorded earlier this week on terrorism, foreign policy, and American democracy. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, of course, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited in their entirety as a public service. Today, we are airing a forum recorded earlier this week on the overlapping issues of terrorism, foreign policy, and American democracy. Specifically, how should we balance the relationship of American national security, both concerns about domestic and international terrorism, with our constitutional and moral principles? The participants in this discussion are Professor Amos Giura with the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, Professor Brent Steele, who is the Warmoth Chair at the Department of Political Science, Ivy Estabrook, she's the Executive Director of USTAR, the Utah Science Technology and Research Initiative, and the conversation is moderated by Mark Button, the Chair of the Department of Political Science. And speaking here next is Daniel K. Brady. He's a Supervisory Special Agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. Brady has worked on issues related to terrorism in North Africa, Europe, and the Middle East for 18 years. He's also now the deputy for the FBI for the region of Utah, Idaho, and Montana.
So I'm sure you students noticed there's a difference between these four panelists. Three of them had the title doctor and one did not. So I'm feeling a little bit intimidated to be here, but it is an honor. And I also was not going to mention that university to the south. Thanks for outing me. I wasn't sure if you were allowed to say that out loud on this campus.
You're welcome.
But let me just real quickly touch on a little bit of my background that I think will be relevant as you assess my opinions and perspective. After down south, I went to the College of William & Mary where I studied law. Mm. And I did practice law for about 7 years before joining the FBI, where I've spent about 18 years. During those 18 years, I've focused mostly on a practitioner level on working terrorism issues. And I have responded, been an early responder to terrorism events, to include suicide bombings. I've had quite a few occasions of interviewing terrorists, and notice the FBI preference for that word, interview. And I have also successfully brought terrorists to a court of law where they have been convicted both after performing attacks and also before when we were able to deter and disrupt their plans. So that's kind of my experience. And before making four general points in response to this dialogue, I want to give you a couple of caveats. First of all, the terrorism events that I've worked on, I know in great detail. However, I've never had the benefit of studying the issues of foreign policy and terrorism from a comprehensive big picture view, and that's why I will really yield to my colleagues on this panel, because I'm really hindered by a very limited view of my casework. The second point, and I really look forward to hearing this dialogue on political questions, but I'm uncomfortable with it. I'm a member of this government, and I am what is called a restricted employee under the Hatch Act, which means that I'm not really supposed to get into the political issues. And this topic is kind of politically charged. So please, whatever I say, coming from my mouth today, I'm not going to endorse one political party over another, and whatever I say is my personal opinion and not the policy of the FBI. So with that said, I kind of want to make four points addressing this dialogue. And the first is, the rule of law should always be our first option in addressing terrorism. I've dedicated my academic and my professional life to its application. And it would be wonderful if around the globe there were competent governments and states and judicial systems with valid treaties between them that we could use to address terrorism. If we had that kind of utopia, I think the rule of law would be sufficient to address terrorism. But I want to tell you a quick story. About 11 years ago, I was in a country that I'm not going to name, but it was in the Sahel. And 4 years prior to that,
a U.S. person, a diplomat, he was a defense attaché for the United States government, he was murdered. This was not a terrorism event, but he was murdered. I was sitting in a neighboring country, and I was in the room with the Minister of Justice and the head of the police, the law enforcement. And I asked them, I said, you know, we have an Interpol red notice. You know I'm sitting on a provisional arrest warrant. If I told you where this perpetrator was within the borders of your country, would you arrest him for me? And they said, absolutely. They said, Dan, you tell us where he is, we will arrest him. So I told them. I kind of sandbagged them. I knew exactly where he was, and he was within the borders of their country. And I told them, here's where he is. And they just kind of looked at their feet, and they said, Dan, we can't enforce the rule of law in that region of our country. It was in the northern region of their country. We would kick off rebellion. There would be insurrection. We cannot take action in that portion of our country. So that's the situation that we're in. There's a large part of the Middle East where there are failed and failing states. And given that, these organizations that we're talking about, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, they spawn when you have a failed and failing states. So given that environment, the rule of law is not adequate to address the terrorism issues that we're facing in the world. Military action is justified. Because these organizations have as their stated purpose to disrupt our national security and to destroy our way of life, we're justified. Not necessarily talking about the attack on Syria, but the use of military against a terrorist organization in a failed or failing state, I believe, is justified by principles of self-defense. Third point, though, given that military action at times can be justified, and this is the core of the dialogue question today, is never should our constitutional principles be given up to go after these terrorist organizations. Our Constitution should always be our guide. And I know there's a lot of studies out there that talk about this notion of balancing national security with individual liberties. I personally reject that. I believe that if we compromise individual liberties, we will, in the long term, be compromising our national security. And I believe that if we don't protect our national security, we will not be able to protect our individual liberties. So I believe the Constitution should always be our guide, and there is a moral aspect to the way this dialogue was framed, and that gets a little bit more difficult, but I believe that our Constitution was framed in such a way that hopefully if we follow it, we'll be pursuing the moral course and the moral actions. But there are some very interesting debates on things that the United States government has done in recent years that call that into question. For instance, torture. And we, I think, can have a conversation there. And the last point I want to make before yielding is, you know, I started with kind of the ideal rule of law. Wouldn't it be wonderful if that were enough? I'd like to close with another ideal, and that is that the use of military against terrorism, I believe we're in a little bit of a catch-22, because no doubt, every time we use conventional warfare or drone attacks or we put boots on the ground, there's no doubt that we are producing additional fodder for these terrorist organizations. And that's where you have this balancing act that gets way above my head. But I do believe that in the long run, the only way that we're going to beat terrorism is if we can build communities. And I'm not talking just internationally, I'm talking domestically and internationally. If we could, I believe everywhere that a terrorist spawns, it's because there have been failed families, failed communities, failed states. And if we could solve that even here, if we had better communities, and if we integrated and assimilated the refugees that we're talking about, if we're going to take them, that's a whole other debate, but we're going to be preventing terrorism. I think it's interesting, and I got this out of a paper, this is not my idea, but when we declared our independence from Britain, it It's interesting because we weren't just declaring our independence. We were declaring our interdependence. We were declaring our unity as states. But beyond that, we were declaring our unity as a community. If we maintain that declaration, and if we're united and have a sense of community, terrorism will never win. It never has in the history of the world. Terrorism has never met its objective. But if we protect our communities and then find a way to help globally other communities thrive, they're going to lose.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Brent Steele.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Professor Button, for putting this together, and thanks to my fellow panelists. It's an honor to be up here. I want to talk a little bit about the meaning of security and how, when it comes to terrorism, a lot of what we do is to go the easy route of thinking that terrorism is something that can be subject to control, and especially the controlling of others. So we have a lot of these narratives of controlling others, whereas I think we haven't had enough discussion about moving from the easy work of thinking that we can control others to the harder work of conditioning ourselves. And when it comes to terrorism, I think that's something that we don't talk enough about, but that actually might be a little bit more productive. But what do I mean right now about narratives of control when it comes to terrorism? Well, we have a couple of them. One is the aforementioned process or tactic of torture. Now, torture historically has been good for a lot of things, not necessarily getting the truth out of people. It's been good for getting confessions, sometimes the not truth, for propaganda purposes. It's been good for demonstrating the authority, the physical authority over the body of someone else, and it's Holy Week, and so we have an example of that as Christians where we reflect upon that this Friday. We don't call it torture, we call it the crucifixion, but it's about the same thing. And third, and this is what I think torture is still useful for, at least in the short term, and that's revenge. But when it comes to moral principles, we can't call our support for torture about revenge. So we have to talk about how it's useful for controlling others and stopping future terrorist attacks. Another set of narratives of control that we have regard retrospectively looking back at the rise of terrorist organizations like ISIS. Here, no matter where you are in the political spectrum, we like to put the United States as a central actor in this tragedy of the rise of ISIS. For some, it's because the United States invaded Iraq to begin with. And if the United States just hadn't invaded Iraq, ISIS wouldn't have come about. And for others, it's because the United States didn't stay long enough in Iraq. So if the United States just would have kept some troops there forever, I guess, ISIS wouldn't have come about. Now, there's some persuasive elements of each of these narratives of control, but they also overlook the other myriad of factors that also can be considered responsible for the rise of ISIS, like the regional dynamics and the different national interests of the regional players there, the Shia-Sunni rivalry that's been around for hundreds of years, the Arab Spring of 2011 that led to some of the disintegration of Syria where ISIS is today. We have some less prosaic and nuanced narratives of control more recently that tell us that we can control others out there if we just, as one presidential candidate said in 2016, make the sand glow in the Middle East, whatever that would look like. Or we have my favorite one, that the problem with terrorism is that we haven't called it terrorism enough. So if we call it radical Islamic jihadist terrorism, poof, it'll go away. Much like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, just saying there's no place like home. But Dorothy had to do an extra step. She had to click her heels. We don't even have to do that. We can just call it radical Islamic terrorism and it's gone. Instead of thinking about narratives of controlling others, I think that there are ways that we haven't talked about conditioning ourselves. Because when it comes to terrorism and terror, and this is also perhaps too simple, but we can start with the notion of we just stop being terrified. We just stop being afraid. Now, that sounds flippant, but we have examples of other societies doing this. The French, in the days and weeks after the Paris attacks, went right back out into the cafes and shopping areas, said we're just not going to be afraid. The Brits have made this into a national identity, or at least tried to, right? The stiff upper lip, be calm, carry on. That they just decide that they're just not going to be afraid and change who they are in the face of terrorism. Now, we don't do stiff upper lip very well here in the United States. We're a little more excitable. But we can think of a couple of ways, I think, to talk about some of these things of conditioning ourselves so that we're not as terrified when terrorism occurs. One is context, and Professor Button already did this to begin with. We're far more likely to perhaps die in a shark attack or die in our toilets. Our toilets are death traps. I don't know if any of you know this, but our toilets toilets are death traps. We're far more likely to die in our toilet than we are in a terrorist attack. Or, more immediately, go to any intersection in the city, not right now, but in a couple hours after this discussion's over with, or any intersection in any city in the United States. The people that are at the intersection in their cars are not looking at the stoplight or stop sign. They're not looking at the pedestrians. And the pedestrians themselves aren't even looking at where they're going. What is everyone looking at? Their phones, yeah. Our phones are far more likely to kill us than a terrorist attack. And so that might not necessarily be a reassuring way to think about terrorism, but it can provide some perspective and context for us. But a second way to condition ourselves is to cultivate perhaps a sensibility regarding this notion of control. And the notion of control has actually been brought up already earlier today. Of the things that we can control and those things that we cannot. I'm thinking here of course, the Serenity Prayer that's been made famous in the context of Alcoholics Anonymous. But before it was even put into that very useful practice and context, it was in a more public context developed as a series of sermons by Reinhold Niebuhr in the early 1940s at a church in Massachusetts where he gave his sermons during the summers. Niebuhr's, the Serenity Prayer, of course, goes something like, God, please grant me the serenity to know the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Reinhold Niebuhr's daughter, Elizabeth Sifton Niebuhr, in the late 1990s, wrote an essay and then a follow-up book about the Serenity Prayer. And she said, actually, though, the only thing she'd change about it is that she wouldn't call it the Serenity Prayer. She'd say, you know, she said that because we have the term serenity, we think that there's just this one moment of peace that kind of comes over us and we can put all of our problems from before behind us forevermore. She argued that it actually takes a lot of effort to embody the notion and the sensibility behind the Serenity Prayer, so perhaps the focus should be more on wisdom and courage. And that's hard work, and it returns to the point that I make at the very beginning and I make now at the very end. It's a lot of hard work to get up and recognize the things that we can control or change from the things that we cannot. But the wisdom to know the difference, I think, is the most that we can do in a democratic society, especially when it comes to terrorism going forward. Thanks.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be with such distinguished panelists. I, too, have a slight disclaimer that I'm only speaking for myself and not for USTAR or the state. Although I don't fall under the Hatch Act anymore, happily I can have stronger opinions. So I want to talk about national security a little more broadly. As over the last 15 years, really, since 9/11 and probably before that, we've made a lot of choices as a nation to put security and countering terrorism above other items in the national interest. If you look at the proposed budget cuts, huge cuts to the National Institutes of Health in order to further fund the defense budget, which we also need to keep in mind, the intel budget is stuck in that large budget, without a lot of discussion of we're making trade-offs. It's all going to be trade-offs. And so what are we doing to our security as a people in terms of health, in terms of maintaining technological superiority across a whole number of fields, and our economic strength in order to build border walls, to 59 Tomahawks is a great big budget I'd be happy to spend on technology. So we need to have this dialogue of what are the broader conditions for all Americans and all people in the world, and what are the trade-offs we're willing to make for security? And also, how are we measuring our security? What is the oversight? I think over the last 15 years since 9/11, I mean, there was discussion this week with the Syria bombing of when was the last AUMF, and somebody will have to help me with that acronym, but the authority for military action really comes from the Patriot Act. So in 16 years, am I wrong?
Right. No, the AUMF right. was initially authorized, to the best of my recollection, in 2004 and
for
Iraq. And
October 2002.
2002 or 2004, 2002, and it's been viewed or perceived or applied beyond
broadly. And I think that that's something there needs to be a national dialogue about, is bombing Syria in this context, which isn't even, it's a state actor, it's not a terrorist act. Does the president really have the authority? And as a nation, do we believe we should be expending resources that way? I also worry about, I don't know if anybody else attended the America's Role in the World that Chris Stewart put on a couple weeks ago downtown. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of discussion and out of town hall as well as, you're never going to see the classified information that I see, and you just have to trust us as leaders in making these decisions and doing oversight. I think we need to re-examine that as a nation and hold leaders accountable. I think terrorism is a great example of leadership was not held accountable. And as citizens, that's our job, and that's part of our role as Americans in the world, is to make sure that our government is honoring the Constitution and is carrying out the foreign policy and national security policy that we believe the Constitution supports and that we as citizens support. Just as a kind of final piece of that, I think we really need to have a discussion on, do the ends always justify the means, which seems to be where we are. Mm-hmm. The lack of a strategy is a challenge. I don't know what our strategy is at this point in terms of, are we going to intervene when there's a civilian crisis, which is what we did in Syria last week? Why aren't we intervening in all of the other places where there are crises going on? But I really think transparency and having a national dialogue on the oversight of these actions is critically important as we go forward.
You are listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we are airing the latest in the Campus Community Dialogue series, Understanding Our Differences, Shaping Our Future, and a conversation about terrorism, foreign policy, and American democracy. This forum is sponsored by the College of Social and Behavioral Science and the Hinckley Institute, the Department of Political Science, and the Undergraduate and Graduate Student Advisory Councils, all at the University of Utah. The panelists today include Professor Amos Gura, he's with the S.J. Quinney College of Law, Special Agent Daniel K. Brady with the FBI, Professor Brent Steele, the Warmoth Chair with the Department of Political Science, Ivy Estabrook, the Executive Director of USTAR, the Utah Science Technology and Research Initiative, and the conversation is moderated by Mark Button, the Chair of the Department of Political Science.
Well, our panelists have done a great job staying on time. I didn't have to interrupt a single person, so I appreciate that, which gives us a lot of time for discussion. And maybe let's just jump in with Dr. Estabrook's last question, because it undercuts a lot of the themes you've been hearing, which is how do we define national security? If we're going to be a part of that conversation and hold leaders accountable, how would we begin to do that? That might be a natural jumping off point for our participation today. So we have student volunteers with microphones. We invite you now to participate, pose your questions, your comments to the panelists, or for all of us. So please, raise your hand and we'll invite you to speak.
Thank you. First of all, I'm not American, I'm Egyptian. We don't have many Egyptian students here at the U. We are only like 10 students. So my question related to Egypt, especially that President Trump met the Egyptian president last week. And the accident that happened, although it was very shocking to the whole world, but this is not the first one that happened in a church. So there were another accident like 2 months ago in a church by like suicide bomber. And it has lots of casualties, like maybe 20 or even more. And the country, like the president, met the Pope, the Coptic Pope, and he said, like, we're gonna declare, like, sorrow for 3 days. And happening that accident now, actually, like, I wouldn't talk a lot about that situation because I know there are lots of questions, but how you guys think that the problem is not, like, you shouldn't like support the president of Egypt because he is, from my personal point of view, the main reason of what is happening now. Mm-hmm. So he is a dictator. He's the second worst dictator of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. He put in prison 80,000 plus of the prisoners who are youth. They are, I have lots of my friends in prison. I was like lecture assistant in Cairo University Faculty of Engineering. One of my best students, he was killed a week after I came here. And he was killed inside Cairo University by the Egyptian police. And during the time that he did not put the emergency law, like the over the 3 years, he put in prison 80,000 plus. And he killed 1,000 plus who were demonstrators against him. And they are not like people carrying weapons. They are not ISIS, by the way. And what he's doing by putting those people in prison and closing all the gates and all like the freedom of speech, he's helping in radicalizing those people in prison. Actually, the accident that happened 2 months ago, that detonator, he was a young guy, he was like 18 years old, and he was put in prison for 1 year without any charge. And during his period in prison without any charge, he got recruited by ISIS members inside the prison. And when he went out, he started to join a cell, and he detonated himself, and he killed people. I don't know about this accident, but this is happening. And not even like talking about the freedom in Egypt and talking about like political solution and trying to minimize the powers of the president of Egypt and giving him the full support in killing more people, putting more people in prison, okay. We are destroying the whole future of Egypt and of the whole Middle East, because Egypt is like more than one third of the population of the Middle East. We have 90 million plus in prison. So how you would even think about like raising that issue or solving that problem, like okay. Not giving him like the full authority right. On what he's doing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, you put a lot of before the panel. Case of Egypt. Maybe Dr. Gyori, will you
sure.
Start with that?
So, you know, Franklin Roosevelt is president, and I apologize for the expression, but we're all adults here. I think this is probably the best answer to what you're saying. Roosevelt said about some Latin American dictator whose name is long forgotten in the annals of history, he's a bastard, but he's our bastard. And I think in many ways, to your question, when President Trump met with Sisi last week or 2 weeks ago, I think there were multiple things going on there. One, you know better than I do that Obama had no interest in meeting with Sisi. Mm-hmm. And again, you know better than I do that Obama was very quick to get rid of Mubarak, right? Throw him under the bus. And I think when Trump met with Sisi, I think it was for two reasons. One, because Obama didn't meet with him, so I'll meet with him. Mm-hmm. And two, he's in this mood of meeting with foreign leaders. And I understand you're under the hatch act, so cover your ears. I think this administration is genuinely, by the way, I have to add in parentheses, I have no idea what this phrase, this administration, means, because mm-hmm. I have no idea who's muttering sweet nothings into his ear. I know he's got Jared here and Ivanka, and then he's got Bannon here who he's about to get rid of. It's a real problem. There's no State Department. There is no State Department. It's a real problem in this incredibly complex world, sorry, when you have a president who's functioning by instinct. Mm-hmm. It's a problem. And so when he met with Sisi, I'm not really sure that he, Trump, really understands the geopolitics of Egypt, Egypt-Israel, Egypt-Syria. I really don't know. I agree with you, there's a certain discomfort factor, and because I live in Israel and you come from Egypt, you and I think are going to agree here that those of us who live in the Middle East are in a state of somewhere between utter confusion and utter disarray in trying to understand what this administration is, because they have not articulated, and I think you and I will agree, what is American national security and what is American foreign policy. And for those of us who live in this combustible thing called the Middle East, it's a state of utter confusion.
Well, I would add to that as American, I feel the same way, that there is confusion. I mean, even yesterday, we heard different opinions from different people in the Trump administration on why Syria happened.
Nikki Haley says this.
Right, exactly. And so I think it gets you in some of your opening comments about what's the strategy. I'm not sure there is a strategy, and that some of these visits, I wonder if they're even thought through or if it's just opportunistic. And that is concerning, I think, for everyone and for those who have to carry out the policy when the policy isn't clear. So.
Hi, I'm Lina Sudin with the Political Science Department. I had a question to the panel, see if you can reflect a little bit about fighting terrorism as a strategy, looking not only at the side of the coin that is terrorists doing things to us, but sort of what in our behavior and our way of life, American way of life, is creating frustrations and confusion and opportunities around the world to express anger at the United States. So not just thinking about cutting taxes, but thinking about increasing our wealth in our communities a little bit.
Professor Steele, would you like to maybe take a crack at that, how the United States might be facilitating?
Yeah, I mean, it does go to one of the sort of narratives of control that I kind of critiqued a little bit, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I don't think that there's some merit to it, and that is, what is the U.S.'s role been in the world historically that maybe has facilitated quite a bit of this? I mean, kind of dovetailing with the point about where some of these individuals get imprisoned and where a lot of them might meet. I mean, ISIS, a lot of the first generation of ISIS leaders, Baghdadi and others, it's kind of assumed that they met one another in prisons in Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom. So that would be one sort of initial way that some of the treatment of individuals can lead to other possibilities that could lead to terrorism. But again, I don't want to say that there's no responsibility for the United States when it comes to facilitating that more broadly. I do think that there could be a little bit more reflection by us on an everyday level in a couple of different ways. One, in terms of what we want for security and what our bar of expectations are for what is secure enough. Because one of the ironies of security is that the more security you try to get, the more insecure you feel. And we can see that, we can experience that at an everyday level, not just when we go to airports, but all of the different things in which lead to what we call security theater. But also, it might be that there are certain things that we focus on in the world and say, oh, isn't that awful, and isn't that horrible, and then others that we just don't pay attention to whatsoever. That might not necessarily foment terrorism, but definitely wouldn't increase our at least moral image in the world. Even Syria is a good example. And one of the things that we forget about in 2013 in Syria was one of the things that made the United States a little bit cautious when it came to intervening, even after the chemical weapons attacks, the chemical weapons attacks are awful. It killed a lot more people in those chemical weapons attacks in 2013 than it even did last week. But a lot of Syrians have been dying in other ways. And we only focus on the chemical attacks because that's an international norm, and the liberal internationalists always want us to protect international norms, but not talking about some of the suffering that had been happening before that. So I think some of those sort of ways to think about the broader role and our the things that we notice and the things that we choose not to notice might get to some of what you're talking about.
Can I add a point?
Yeah, sure.
So some of my students are here. So, I, for 20 years, was involved in operational counterterrorism while serving in the IDF. And I think this goes to your question, and maybe also to Brent's point here. Every counterterrorism measure, tactical. Every counterterrorism policy, strategy, you as a decision maker have to ask yourself, what is the goal, strategic and tactical? And there's a difference between tactical thinking and strategic thinking. So to your question, meeting with Sisi strikes me as tactical and not strategic. Bombing Syria strikes me as tactical and not strategic. Now, there is a school of thought, and I'm sure Brent's an expert on this, that says that in the contemporary age, it's very difficult to have a coherent strategy. It's much easier to go from tactic to tactic. But I think at the end of the day, call it a strategy of tactic rather than a strategy of strategy, is convenient and easy. At the end of the day, I think it's going to be counterproductive because it doesn't go to the core question that you're really posing here.
Mm. Great. All right. Right here in the back.
Hello, my name is Ian Ward. Thank you to the panelists. My question is, over the since September 11, 2001, we've seen acts like the Patriot Act, we've seen Snowden's revelations on the NSA. There was talk about the trade-off as a society between civil liberties and national security. With our last two presidential candidates, neither of them running on any type of basis of ending maybe drone strikes of American citizens, ending Patriot Act, ending NSA spying. And with the election of maybe the most fear candidate, Trump, does this mean that as a society we've embraced the trade-off towards national security? Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Great question. Now, we recognize that you can't speak on behalf of the government, Agent Brady, but this would be a great question to have your perspective on.
Sure. Again, and I kind of touched on this in my opening remarks, because we talk a lot about the trade-offs between national security and civil liberties, and we talk about things like what kind of tools should we have. And to be totally honest with you, I completely concur with a lot of the notions that we've heard, and that is that we're more likely to die, was it a shark attack?
Or the bathroom. Shark attack in the bathroom.
And within the FBI, I'm thinking we should open some classifications on shark attacks and bathroom mishaps. Because it is true that we have finite resources, and we've touched on that a little bit. And everything that we, Congress and the American people, because we have been so terrorized by terrorism, have insisted that within the FBI that it has to be our number one priority. Terrorism is our number one priority. And does that really make sense? And I've, frankly, and I'm going on a limb here, I've never really thought that it does, and yet I'm the subject matter expert on terrorism as far as those investigations go. You touched on the Patriot Act and what kind of tools do we have to protect the American people from terrorist attacks, you know, to protect our national security. And there is no doubt in my mind that we have very limited tools, and we're very good, despite what Snowden revealed. We are very good at protecting the civil liberties of the American people with the tools that we have as protected and guarded by the Constitution. We do a really poor job at defending ourselves, and that was very frustrating to me with the Snowden revelations. You didn't see anybody in the government really defending what we have done as an intelligence community and how we have done it within the guidelines of the Constitution. But the point is, though, that certainly I could have more tools, and certainly without these tools, there may be more terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. But is it worth it? And I'm, for one, of the opinion that it's not, because I think we're more threatened in the long term by losing our civil rights and our civil liberties than we are by terrorism as it's threatening us today. You touched on drone attacks, and I know that's a little bit sensitive. Your question actually covered a wide range of things, and on drone attacks, that's a really interesting question, and that's an interesting moral question. If there were an active shooter on campus today, and if that active shooter were taking out students from a bell tower, which is a scenario that occurred in U.S. soil, and if we had a sniper from the FBI SWAT team who could stop that guy before more students were killed, is that moral to shoot that sniper or to shoot the bad guy who's killing students? Is that constitutional? Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it's moral. I think drone attacks are a little bit the same way, because if our drone attacks are going after people that we know are trying to kill us, that may be the most efficient solution. Now, of course, it's horrible that civilians get in the way, but you'd have civilian casualties with conventional attacks as well. So I know I've been all over the map, but I think that addresses your
I wonder if the other panelists agree with this question on the issue of drones.
Yeah.
Dr. Esper?
So I would push back on that, and I think there have been there are a couple of challenges, I think, with the use of drones. One is the authority under which we're doing a lot of this killing, I think, really questions whether the people we're killing are a threat to us. And what does it mean when you're killing someone in Somalia with a drone? Is that really a threat to us in the United States? And I think that gets back into so much of the information is classified intelligence. There isn't a national discussion on it. There isn't a transparency discussion on what is the level of threat to the United States or to Americans abroad that allows us to kill people. And I think that's a huge problem. I also think as I'm a cognitive neuroscientist, mm-hmm. when you think about decision making and how we make decisions, there is the ability to reduce, when you're using a drone instead of a special forces team, for example, to go after someone in one of these locations, there's very little human risk to Americans, right? You're not making the threshold for what is going to happen to US assets goes down quite a bit. It's much easier to say it's worth the kill at a lower threshold of what the risk is because you're not putting any humans in that loop, in that attack. And I think that's a conversation we haven't had either. And there are downstream consequences. If you look at one of the communities that has the highest rate of PTSD is the guys that fly drones from Nevada in the Air Force. And I think there's a biological mechanism you're not kicking your fight or flight mechanism if you're not really being threatened. So I realize my answer is also all over the place, but I do think that there needs to be a larger discussion on the use of drones and what that kill chain looks like and the authority to do it. The other thing that was reported, I think, only by, it might have been Bloomberg, is that Trump has moved that authority for use of drones back to the CIA.
Back to the DOD.
No, he moved it from DOD to CIA.
Back to DOD.
And he's moved it back to DOD. Fine. Okay.
Because he knew you were going to say that.
He knew I was coming for him. That does make me feel better, but that gets back into the oversight piece.
Did you want
to? I did. So while serving the IDF for 20 years, I was involved what we call targeted killing, which in the American is called drones. So mm-hmm. I did that while serving the IDF. I'm going to push back on the pushback.
Thanks.
I'm sitting next to you. So what we call target killing, which America has called drones, makes sense if. And the if is huge. And that goes, I think, to your question. The if is if you can genuinely and narrowly and specifically define the following terms. Those of you who are thinking about law school, this is for you. One, what is national security? Two, what is a legitimate target? And the follow-up question to that is, when is the legitimate target a legitimate target? It's not enough to say that Joe is the legitimate target. That's too easy. The question is, when is Joe a legitimate target? Because in the Israeli paradigm, you can only do a targeted killing when that legitimate target poses, in the magical phrase, an imminent threat to how we in Israel define Israeli national security. The American drone policy is articulated, using the term very loosely, in a Department of Justice white paper that was, you can find it all over the internet, that was written in the Obama administration. Because I can only quote myself, it is an abominable piece of work, unsigned, because if I had written it, I too would want it unsigned. Because what it really did, and now I'm going to agree with you, is it gives a carte blanche to the American administration to conduct drone policy in an inarticulated, unlimited, unchecklisted fashion. Your question is excellent, because the only way, full circle, to have an effective, however we define that, national security counterterrorism policy is if we narrowly and specifically define legitimate target and person-specific counterterrorism. Otherwise, we have something that is literally carte blanche, and to your question, the consequences and the pushback and the blowback and the bounce back are endless.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Right here.
So we had some discussion about rule of law not working because of the corrupt nature of various governments, and that in some cases that meant that military action was justified. My question would be, what is the sense of the efficacy of sanctions? And I'd love to hear how people feel about sanctions from each of the members.
Great.
Sanctions
Do you want to get us started on that, Agent Green?
Well, sure, only to say that I don't know. I would much prefer that we attempt to use our diplomatic resolutions and sanctions to the extent possible. That would always be a preference to do that before resorting to a military action. But that, and I'm risking getting a little political here, but that also becomes a resource issue. We have just absolutely raped and pillaged our entire budget of our State Department to the point that, you know, we could hardly do anything because it's all gone to the military. So it's kind of a resource question. But I think sanctions should be tried first, to be simple.
And this might play into some of your comments, Dr. Steele, about control, forms of control, sanctions, diplomacy, military interventions. What do you think about that question?
No, I mean, I think it's a good point. I think one of the things to note about whether it's sanctions or drones or anything else is that it may serve the function of deterring or being a form of influence short of military force, but it is also imperfect. And it also might serve more the function of us feeling like we're doing something against a bad regime than necessarily doing something that will prevent terrorism later on down the line or prevent some other kind of suboptimal scenario later on down the line. And one of the other aspects of sanctions, even though they've been refined quite a bit over the years, and they can be important and they can be very effective, is that they are applied, and we have smart sanctions, so there's a little bit of caveat here, but they are applied against a state. But they don't necessarily equally influence everyone across the society. There are certain people, individuals, vulnerable populations within those countries that are impacted asymmetrically by those sanctions. And so we might feel better because we have sanctions against Iran or sanctions against Russia or whatever, but the regime that's responsible for a lot of the things that we are trying to alter maybe isn't the one that's bearing the brunt of that. So even sanctions, I agree, when it comes to different tactics and strategies, sanctions are something that I would much prefer over military force. But sometimes they can be just as costly as military force as well. The 1990s sanctions regime in Iraq was incredibly costly, and incredibly costly and violent even against the most vulnerable parts of that population.
And quite simply, too, if we're resorting to sanctions, we're assuming that we have time. You would want to look at another option if we had credible intelligence that the particular target was on the verge of an attack, which does happen. Of course, that touches again on the transparency issue, but you know, you have to weigh that. You know, how much time do we have to deal with whatever the problem is in that region of the failed state?
Can I ask? I'm curious. Your statement about the, I don't know if it's political, then somebody else can answer it. You know, cutting the State Department. To me, we've just eliminated all of our carrots in foreign policy by cutting foreign aid and some of the, even the exchange programs we do with other countries, educational outreach, et cetera. How do we come back from that, or have we decided as a strategy that carrots don't work in these contexts?
See, I knew you guys would push me completely out of, I'm probably going to get fired.
With, right. We'll hire you when you get fired.
So when I was overseas, I was always functioning within embassy environments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was frustrating to no end that the State Department just seemed to never have USAID, whatever, they never had adequate funding, and yet, and I'm really on a limb because a friend of mine's in the audience who was connected with DOD overseas, but the DOD offices had unlimited budget to do really foreign aid type work.
Yep. There's a drone
and
above
they weren't.
There's a drone.
they're not our experts,
right,
on
totally
foreign aid.
Totally.
So over the years, and I'll try to save my job here, it hasn't just been the recent administrations. It's been a pattern that's gone back over the last 20 years. You've just watched our State Department get castrated.
Eviscerated.
We have time for one more question. We'll give it to Dean Berg.
I'm really struck with your comment about terror and the ability of the U.S. to just get it's very salient for us to seem terrified. And I'd be curious your sort of political or cultural explanation for why that would be the case. Because in some ways, we're very similar. We actually have very much fewer terror attacks than something like France. You could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I have a long answer to that and a short answer, and I'll try to give the short answer. But I'm not sure. I am curious as to whether this is a feature of the last 20 to 25 years in the United States or it's something that goes more broadly. I think there is probably historical reasons why the United States doesn't react to surprises or surprise violent situations as well as other societies. But I also think a little bit of it has to do with the sense of decline. The United States can't quite control the world in ways that it thinks that it could have before, when it really wasn't really able to control the world as well as we narrate it now. Anyway, but this sense of, well, we can't control the world, and there was a question about Trump and whether national security is over civil liberties. I'm not even sure it's national security. It's sort of a politics of trying to get something back that we feel is lost. And that is in this broader sort of trend of decline. And so this is coupled with the feature of society around us that everything feels like it's out of control. Late modernity is so rapid and so fast, and we build up all of these routines where we think we can control our everyday lives, and then if one little thing in our routine goes out of whack, we get into a car accident or a traffic jam or whatever, then everything feels like it's out of control again and very chaotic. And our phones, by the way, add to that sense of, well, we have control over information, but that information makes us feel like we're out of control. And so I think there is something in the United States, if you couple both of those features that aren't just unique to the United States but are fairly prevalent to the United States, that make us a little bit more vulnerable to terrorism, even though we are not that vulnerable to the physical impacts of terrorism nearly as much as you might think. And coupled with the fact that it is in the sort of interests of our media, and I don't just mean cable networks or television, but our broader networks and media, to facilitate that sense of insecurity as well.
Dr. Esterbrook, any perspective from cognitive neuroscience on this question?
Well, I think our amygdalas are out of control. But I do think the constant kind of drumming and narrative and an expectation of being safe. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not sure every citizen of the world has the same expectation of safety that Americans do. And so it goes back to resource trade-offs. I don't think we're having the discussion of what we're trading off for this safety. And that is going to become more and more palpable as budgets get cut, as our healthcare declines because we're spending so much in defense. And I'm right there with you. And Secretary Mattis said in 2013, for every dollar you cut from the State Department, you're going to have to buy me more bullets because we're losing that balance. And I don't think we're having enough of a dialogue nationally about those trade-offs. But it's definitely your amygdala.
Okay. We'll keep an eye on that. We want to now invite our panelists to offer some final concluding thoughts, reflecting on what they've heard from each other, thinking about the questions that all of you posed, which have been very, very good. So each panelist, about 3 to 5 minutes, thinking about how we might proceed. One of the big issues that came out of this discussion today was about how we define national security. I'd love to have your thoughts about that. If you were an advisor to Trump on that national security team, what kinds of things would you be saying in that room? We'd love to have your final thoughts on this. Dr. Giora, let's start with you.
So two final thoughts. First of all, thanks for having me. Two final thoughts. One, because I'm the lawyer, right? You too, I know, but was. We lawyers teach our students to define terms. And not only do we teach students to define terms, but where we are really irritating is that we teach students to apply whatever they've defined. So that what we have not done here, for instance, terrorism, right? We've talked about terrorism, you know, forever, till your hair looks like my hair. And what is essential here is whatever term you want to define it. And that's essential. So if Trump were to call me and say, hey, Giora, how do you define terrorism? I would say that terrorism is an act by a group or by an individual for one of four purposes, religious, social, economic, political, to advance whatever cause they have. You agree with my definition, disagree with my definition, but at least there has to be a working definition, because the rule of law, and to your excellent question in the back about balancing, it's all utterly and totally predicated on how you define and then how do you apply that definition. Second point. There's a word that we haven't really mentioned here, which is essential to discussion, and that's media.
when 100 years ago, so I think I'm the oldest person in the room, the media was ABC, NBC, and CBS. Some of you may have heard of those stations. And then it morphed into something called CNN. Some of you may have heard of CNN. And now everybody's a reporter. All of you have an iPhone, right? Kids are born with an iPhone. They come out of the oven with an iPhone. And the role of the media is something that must be discussed, because if I were in the business of grading the media in terms of how they are engaged in this incredibly complicated world, the media gets at best an F, at best. Because they're failing to ask the really, really hard questions. For instance, why attack Syria, or why not attack Syria? And not in a 20-second soundbite. We've become this 20-second soundbite culture, which is awful. There's no way to have an in-depth discussion if you can't make an elevator speech about why attack Syria, right? Then you got Nikki Haley saying this, and the Secretary of State saying that, and they're totally at opposites with each other. I mean, it's extraordinary. And the media, for me, has become passive rather than aggressive in terms of forcing whichever administration, Obama, Bush, Carter, whoever, and Trump, to really, goes to your question, to articulate a strategy, not to explain the tactics and not to have Sean Spicer up there saying whatever the hell he's saying, but to articulate a strategy. Devoid of that, there is no real conversation.
Great. Thank you.
You're looking for comments to wrap things up, and I feel like we're just getting started. And especially you touched on media, because that's something we didn't talk about at all. Our media is really, to an extent, blowing this out of proportion, but the media that's really crushing my world every single day is the media of these organizations that's hitting our shores all over the place. We have no strategy whatsoever on how to defeat that. So even if we did eliminate ISIS, as far as the state that they have, that they're so desperate to cling to, because if they don't have a state, they're not an Islamic
state.
But even if we were wipe them out tomorrow, we would not have defeated the problem, because they're so good at the media, and we don't have a strategy whatsoever.
Better than us.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely better than us. I guess my closing point would be, you mostly as students, what I'm taking away from hearing the problem, and I completely concur with, is that we really have no strategy, and you guys can make a difference. You need to engage into this problem as voters, and as voices, you need to engage. And going back to my very simplistic point at the beginning, I truly believe that building communities is the only thing that's going to work in the long term, and you can build those communities from wherever you sit, anywhere in the world. So.
So I don't have much to add, just a couple of points. I guess if, rather than being sort of atmospheric, as I've been in some of my other comments, if I had to sort of provide a policy suggestion, I think one of the things that could redound to all of us and we'd all benefit from, and would perhaps confront some of the, at least some of the events of terrorism that we've seen over the last couple of years, at least here in the United States, that I would suggest would be to make it rain when it came to the resources devoted to mental health support in this country. I know that sounds really sort of, it's not very sexy, it's not really exciting, but it's something that I worry about far more when it comes to our notions of security, not just national security, but on an individual level. When we talk about people being insecure, it's not about physical security, it's about other forms of security that can then impact national security more broadly, especially if they get an Uzi in their hand. I would say, we could promote gun control, but that I've given up on that ever happening in this country. But even when we talk about gun control, one of the things that a broader group of legislators and folks from all sides of the political spectrum can agree upon is an increase in mental health support. And I think that would help quite a bit. And I just want to echo what the agent mentioned about being involved. Politicians, elites, commentators, they respond to people power. And they respond to what I would argue is this conditioning of ourselves, so that if maybe we, didn't act so terrified all the time, we weren't pulling our hair out. And this is easy for me to say in this nice, quiet, calm, controlled environment here. It's not so easy when you see someone getting their head cut off on your phone, or you see a terrorist attack being covered nonstop by every single cable news network. But if we sort of promoted a little bit more of that sensibility and drew upon that when we visit these town halls or do some other forms of our political activity, that might redound back to our politicians who otherwise try to take the easy way out. Thanks.
So I think everybody's comments are right on. I would stress that we need a national strategy, not just a national security strategy, but a national strategy where our priorities are and how we're going to resource them and what we're going to trade off. Because it's all, at this point, it's all about trade-offs. I would also, being in front of students, encourage you to engage in state and federal government. Being a special agent is a really hard job, but there's a lot of value in getting that firsthand perspective. Go work for your congressman for a while. Go work at the State Department. There are great opportunities for students to go work at many of these federal agencies and get an idea of what it's really like both at the tactical level and at the strategic level to make these changes and understand how complex and complicated they are, but also give your perspective and your ideas. I think that's one of the big challenges in national security and at the national level, national strategic level, is we're getting a lot of ideas within a certain group of people who have been seeped and studied in it. And I did my 14 years in the Beltway, and it is refreshing to be in Utah and getting other perspectives on it. So I'd strongly encourage you to think about spending a part of your career contributing to the national good.
Great. Well, a great point to end on. Please join me in thanking all of our panelists.
This has been another Campus Community Dialogue series, Understanding Our Differences, Shaping Our Future, a conversation about terrorism, foreign policy, and American democracy. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.